you.
I'm just going to encourage those of you that have not participated in that to take advantage of these folks in the class and just ask them what it's like. Frankly, I can't think of anything better to take your children to really show them what missions is all about. You know, it's close by. Just drive down there. It's only a weekend. And I can tell you it has a huge impact on children when they just see what other people need and just the opportunities to share Christ in meaningful ways. We're going to be looking at the gospel as Job explained it and as Elihu restated it. I had a raft of scientific discoveries I was going to talk to you about this morning. But I got something special for you. And it's something I actually developed for my younger son's heavy metal band. So they have this heavy metal band called Channel Darkness. And I found out that the guys in the band are all budding astronomers. And so they wound up talking to them for a whole evening about cosmic darkness and how fine-tuned the darkness is. Well, they wound up talking to me into developing a slideshow for them. They're going to be the one band that actually has a slideshow running while they play. So, but they encouraged me to share this with you because they actually wound up writing a song based on this show. And the theme of it is basically galaxies, but showing how unusual our galaxy is compared to other galaxies. You know, there's a big project underway by NASA to find planets around other stars, and they're rather shocked to discover that we're not finding any solar system analogs. Our solar system indeed has the unique characteristics that allows life to exist, and we're not seeing anywhere else. So buried in this slideshow, I've got a shot of our galaxy. What I want you to do is just kind of look at the show and pick out the galaxy that has life in it. And then we'll talk a little bit about why the other galaxies are not candidates for life. In fact, astronomers are rapidly coming to the conclusion that even though the observable universe may contain, about 250 billion galaxies, that there's probably just one that has the characteristics that makes life possible. Now, this is going to go quickly. There's only 2 seconds on each galaxy. But I did throw slides in there to give you an idea of what the full spectrum of galaxies look like. And, you know, ours is one of these galaxies that are in here. So let me get this up and running for you. Is highly distorted in the sense that almost everything I was showing you were spiral galaxies. That's because they look pretty. If you want to know what a typical galaxy looks like, the most common galaxy in the universe looks like okay, let's pull that one up. There you go. That's what a typical galaxy looks like, a little small, what we call a small elliptical galaxy. So, and even more common than this kind of a galaxy would be this. Okay. Well, it's actually the Omega Globular Cluster. But the Omega Globular Cluster has now been classified as a dwarf galaxy. It's got 10 million stars in it. And it's, you know, the typical globular cluster has only 100,000 stars. This one has 10 million. And so they now realize that it's a captured dwarf galaxy. But these kinds of galaxies probably make up 95 to 98% of all the galaxies in the universe. Now, in terms of the big galaxies, the really big galaxies that have a couple hundred billion stars in them, only 6% of them are spiral galaxies. Let me give you a more typical shot of what a large galaxy would be like. I think this is one. Let me take a look at it. That's the center of a large galaxy. Let me actually get a galaxy up here. I think this is one. Nope. Hard to tell in these little shots here. Okay, let me try this one. Nope, not that one either. Oh boy, I'm sorry. Maybe this one? Can you check it out? Nope. Ah, here we go, I think. Yeah. This is what a typical large galaxy looks like. And, you want me to review them for you. You've got what we call the spherical galaxies and the elliptical galaxies. This is an elliptical galaxy, which means that the spiral structure has long ago collapsed. And so the galaxy has shrunk, and now the stars are very densely packed into a spherical or an ellipsoidal configuration. This particular galaxy is about 20 times bigger than our galaxy. Huge galaxy, but its spiral structure has long ago collapsed. It's rather challenging to have a galaxy sustain its spiral structure for 10 billion years. Far more typical as they start off that way, but rather quickly collapse into this structure. In fact, if a galaxy stops producing stars, within 3 or 4 revolutions, that galaxy will collapse into something like this. So as the universe gets older and older, more and more of the galaxies transform into something like this. But galaxies are a lot like stars in the sense that you get very few big galaxies and you get a lot of really tiny galaxies. So the universe is dominated by what we call dwarf galaxies. Now there's a new category called a sub-dwarf galaxy. And so they weren't able to see the sub-dwarfs because it's so tiny, but now we realize the sub-dwarfs make up at least 90% of the galaxies in the universe, and the dwarfs make up 90% of what's left, and the unusual galaxies are the big ones, which is rather strange because when you look at clusters of galaxies, it seems crowded. The field seems jammed with these large galaxies. Let me pick up a cluster for you. Okay, here's one. That's typically what the universe looks like. Just jam-packed with galaxies. And that's because the universe is so young. It's only 14 billion years old, and so the galaxies, the universe has not been expanding long enough for the galaxies to spread very far apart. And one of the unusual features of where our Milky Way galaxy resides, it resides in a place where there are very few neighboring galaxies and even fewer neighboring galaxy clusters. So we live in one of the most sparsely populated parts of our universe. And if you look at planet Earth as an analogy, our Milky Way galaxy is in the Northwest Territories of Canada or the desert of Australia. It's a place where very few neighbors exist. But this is much more typical of what the universe looks like, galaxies jam-packed together. And, of course, this photo only shows you the really big galaxies. And, by the way, these are really big galaxies. The bigger features you see there, those galaxies are like 40 to 50 times the size of our galaxy. So our galaxy, it'd be very difficult to even see the image of our galaxy on this scale. Yes. Well, there are two arms that dominate what you see in the sky. Our galaxy has quite a few spiral arms, but there are two that you see when you go outside. And depending where you are on the planet, the Orion arm will dominate, or the Sagittarius arm will dominate. You can also see pieces of the Perseus arm. So, then there's the globular clusters that are scattered throughout the sky. And that's typical, too, of the large galaxies, is that you see these globular clusters, or what may be more accurately referred to as sub-dwarf galaxies, orbiting about our galaxy. Our particular Milky Way galaxy has 150 globular clusters orbiting about it. Let me show you what a typical globular cluster looks like. Okay, where do we go here? That's a giant one. Let's pick up a small one. I'm not getting these. By the way, here's one I think is... here we go. Yeah, this is a typical globular cluster. It's orbiting about our galaxy. About 100,000 stars in that one. That's the one several you saw through my telescope. That's the one in Hercules. And you can actually see a lot of those stars through a reasonably sized telescope. In fact, this photograph was taken with a 20-inch telescope, so you don't even need a very large telescope to pick these things up. That's because it's one of the nearby globular clusters. By the way, as one of the design features of where our sun happens to reside, we have the unusual situation or galaxy of our star being nowhere near a globular cluster. All the globular clusters, even though there's 150 of them in our galaxy, none of them are nearby to our star. By the way, didn't you pick up our galaxy as I went through this one? And what's unusual about our galaxy? There's one galaxy that was really unusual compared to all the others. Anybody pick it out? Number 37 from the end. All right. Well, you are right. Our galaxy is slightly barred. That's what our galaxy looks like. Now, when that went by, I noticed several of you went, as that went by. And that was good because you noticed it was different from all the other galaxies. Now, what is particularly unusual about our Milky Way galaxy is its incredible symmetry. Now, the galaxy arms really aren't, I mean, they're highly symmetrical, very circularly distributed, and that's not true of any of the other galaxies we're looking at. And when you do see a bar in other galaxies, the bar is usually very big. Ours has a small bar. And again, the bar is quite symmetrical. It's not disturbed. If I could say one thing about all the other spiral galaxies we've looked at, they're all disturbed. Our galaxy has a property of being very symmetrical and relatively undisturbed. Now, if it was completely undisturbed, the spiral structure would collapse. So it's got to be a little bit disturbed. Because the only way you can sustain spiral structure is by the galaxy eating dwarf galaxies. And if it eats galaxies that are a little bit on the big side, and that's the problem with the Andromeda galaxy. Maybe I can show you our neighbor. Okay, Earth is situated right about where that X is, right there, in between two spiral arms. And it's in between two spiral arms that are relatively far apart, and in between two spiral arms that have very little substructure. Now, if you look at this, you'll see that there is some substructure in between the spiral arms, little spurs and feathers. But our Milky Way galaxy is the property of having very few feathers and spurs. And if we were to bump into one of those feathers or spurs, it would be bad news. Not bad news for bacteria, but bad news for anything bigger than, say, a small mouse. And we're certainly in that category. So it's a good thing that we live in a galaxy that is, I mean, you can see a little tiny, you can see a couple of small spurs right here. But we're over here in between two spiral arms where there's very little spurring or feathering of the spiral arms. Now, if I were to show you something more typical, here's a spiral galaxy that's relatively close to ours. And you can see it's quite disturbed. A lot of violent and aggressive star formation going on in the spiral arms. The spiral arms are still trying to approach some level of stability, even though this is relatively old. You also notice it's got a very small bulge, and if the bulge is too tiny, the heavy elements don't get out into the spiral arms. And this particular spiral galaxy, this is M33, or the one in Triangulum, is about the smallest galaxy you can get and still have spiral structure. So it's quite a bit smaller than our spiral galaxy. And because it is smaller, it gets beat up more when it absorbs dwarf galaxies. And it's the relative size of your galaxy and the galaxy that the galaxies it's absorbing. So because this is so small, when it does eat little dwarf galaxies and merge them into its system, it tends to disturb it more violently than it would ours. Question in the back? Okay. This one? We took a spaceship outside and kind of looked down on it. Right, you can't do that. It was mainly done through radio astronomy observations. Because in radio astronomy, the light is not impeded by the dust in your galaxy. So when you look up at the night sky, you made the comment, you know, you see the Milky Way and you look up the night sky, you're really only looking at a couple of spiral arms. Everything else is blocked out of your view. However, radio wavelengths, you can cut through all that intervening dust that doesn't block your view. And through radio astronomy, we can actually reconstruct the structure of our Milky Way galaxy. This is a rather detailed and accurate depiction of what our galaxy looks like. The most difficult thing for the radio astronomers to piece together was the structure of the bar. In fact, this particular reconstruction is only about 9 months old. And what the astronomy community was waiting for was a detailed, accurate description of what the bar feature looked like. The spiral arms they had kind of nailed down, even 10, 15 years ago. But it's only been in the recent era that... this is the first time astronomers actually been able to show you exactly what our galaxy looks like. Yes, there is a black hole in the center of our Milky Way galaxy, but it's quite a bit smaller than, say, the black hole in the center of the Andromeda galaxy. Now, let me... here's Andromeda right here. So this is called the twin of our Milky Way galaxy, but it's hardly a twin. It's a little more than twice as big as our Milky Way galaxy, so it's bigger. And because it's bigger, it has attracted a lot more dwarf galaxies around it. And this particular galaxy you see right down here has actually passed through the center of the Andromeda galaxy. So it's on the way out. And when it passed through, what it did is it distorted and warped the spiral arms. So you can see if there's a subtle warp in these spiral arms. That was caused by this galaxy. And this galaxy is fairly large. And because of its size, when it did collide with the Andromeda galaxy, it wasn't assimilated into the core of the galaxy. It literally passed right through. Now, it was quite a bit bigger. It was about 6 times bigger when it first collided with the Andromeda galaxy. So it's lost 5/6 of its mass to the big neighbor. But, you know, the big neighbor also had its structure significantly disturbed by the encounter. And so if you have a really large galaxy, it's much more likely to gobble up sizable galaxies in its neighborhood. By the way, our galaxy will eventually be eaten up by the Andromeda galaxy. That's on the calendar. 4.5 billion years from now, our galaxy will be absorbed. Well, and when that happens, it's going to be really bad news for the economy. So both galaxies will have... and, you know, as we went through this, I think you got to see what happens when galaxies collide. It's not a pretty thing when the two galaxies... By the way, when two galaxies have a head-on collision, typically no star will crash into a star in the other galaxy. Galaxies are essentially empty space, and so the stars will pass through one another. However, the structure of both galaxies winds up being extremely disturbed. Just to give yes. Well, when did that happen? Let's see. By the way, the guy who worked all this physics out is the astronomer that heads up Reasons to Believe in South Africa, David Block. He was part of this research that he actually headed up the team that came up with this. And he was able to discern that by doing detailed photographs of the Andromeda galaxy and this particular galaxy. This one's called the NGC 205. By looking at both of them in infrared wavelengths. But I'm trying to remember his research paper. I think we're looking at about 400 million years ago that the collision took place. So, and there's still effects of that collision. In other words, it'll take another 500 million years before this disturbance actually dies down to a reasonable level. So, yeah. Galaxies that have a lot of star formation still going on in them will either be irregular or spiral. And much more frequently, they're irregular. Let me see if I can show you an irregular galaxy. Here's a typical irregular galaxy. They're usually smaller than the spiral galaxies, but this is a galaxy that actually has a lot more star formation going on in it than our own galaxy. This is the Large Magellanic Cloud. It's the largest galaxy that's in the vicinity of our Milky Way galaxy, and it has this bar. And there's almost a bit of a spiral structure you can see here, but obviously it doesn't have well-formed spiral arms. But all this red stuff you see here are regions of very aggressive star formation that are going on. But you notice it's going on everywhere. It's not in any kind of symmetrical structure. So, and by the way, this galaxy eventually will be absorbed by our galaxy. It'll happen about 4 billion years from now, just before the two of them get gobbled up by the Andromeda galaxy. And by the way, typical in galaxy clusters is you get major merging events about every billion years. It's much less seldom because the galaxies are so far apart in our local group. Yeah. In the sense that, you know, typically your red regions are areas of ionized hydrogen. And in order to get that red color, the ionized hydrogen has to be fairly dense. And given the density, we know that will form a lot of stars. Well, you notice there are regions of star formation, because this is actually a fairly accurate reconstruction of what our galaxy looks like. And what the astronomers actually did is indicate the regions where star formation is taking place. But unlike, say, the Andromeda galaxy or even the Large Magellanic Cloud, you notice that there are no regions of very aggressive star formation. And this is good for life. I mean, if you had some zones, like in here, for example, to give you an idea, this little structure here is called a tarantula. I got some slides of that. I'm not going to show it to you today. This tarantula nebula is about 1,000 times bigger than the Orion Nebula. And this tarantula nebula, we're in our galaxy, and we're as close to us as the Orion Nebula. It would stretch about 25 to 30 degrees across the sky. And so, and the Orion Nebula is quite a good distance. It's 1,800 light years away. But if we had one of these gaseous nebulae in our own galaxy at that distance, that's what it would look like. It would literally dominate the night sky. And would be bright enough that you could read newspapers by it. So, yeah. Well, that's a good question. It's kind of like defining a planet.
Yeah.
You got to cut it off somewhere. For example, there's been some discussion just in the past 6 months about reclassifying Omega Centauri as a dwarf galaxy rather than as a globular cluster because it does have 10 million stars in it. And if I can pick that up again for you, some of the discussion, here it is. Okay, one of the reasons why and this is how they're trying to define it, is if it's got non-spherical shape to it, then we would call it a galaxy. And see, this globular cluster is so large that it actually has a little ellipse. I mean, you can see an ellipsoidal shape to it. And if it were smaller, it would be spherically shaped. But because of its huge size, it's able to come up with a non-spherical structure. The fact that it's got 10 million stars in it is enough for astronomers to say this really is. Because there are sub-dwarf galaxies that we've been calling galaxies for decades that are smaller than this. And so it's kind of like the discussion over Pluto, is that, you've got to come up with something that is consistent. So two of the globular clusters in the around Andromeda galaxy and two around our galaxy are being reclassified as sub-dwarf galaxies in the process of being absorbed. Question here? What's that big yellow thing? Okay. Yellow is the color of old stars. And the blue is the color of young stars. And so, as I said, it's difficult to sustain the spiral structure. You can only sustain the spiral structure if the galaxy is absorbing dwarf galaxies. And typically what happens is the dwarf galaxy will get sucked into here, And then there's forces at work which will force the gas in the dwarf out into the spiral arms, where that gas can be used to make new stars. Whereas the stars that are in the dwarf galaxy will remain in the center. And since those stars are typically been shining for a long time, that explains this yellow color you see there. So the old stars tend to stay put. The gas in the galaxies and the gas in the dust gets spun out into the spiral arms where they can make new stars. That bar is a feature that tells us that our Milky Way galaxy must have absorbed a fairly large dwarf galaxy in the relatively recent past. You won't get a bar unless there's been a recent absorption event. On the other hand, we notice the bar is kind of small. The fact that the bar is small tells us it wasn't a very large galaxy. And so astronomers are thinking that maybe about 750 million years ago, maybe 600 million years ago, there was a merger event between our galaxy and a galaxy that would have been slightly smaller than the Large Magellanic Cloud. If I can go back to the Large Magellanic Cloud here, this galaxy is 6% the mass of our galaxy. And if it absorbed something that big, we would have gotten a larger disturbance. It probably absorbed something about 2 or 3% the mass of our galaxy, and that would explain this bar feature here. But yeah, right in the very center is a giant black hole. You say, how big? Oh, about 3 million times the mass of our star, the Sun, which is relatively small for a nuclear black hole in a big galaxy. The Andromeda galaxy has got a much bigger one, for example. And because it's got a much bigger one, you got much more deadly radiation coming out of here. So this would not be a nice galaxy in which we would want to move. It's disturbed. You can see the warping here. We also recognize that it's going to relatively soon absorb more dwarf galaxies. This one's coming up for absorption. And then there's this nasty black hole here. And as you notice, the spiral arms are not nearly as symmetrical as the spiral arms in our galaxy. There's, you know, one or two dominant spiral arms here. You also see you've got very aggressive zones of star formation going on here, which is not the case in ours. In ours, you just have small pockets where you've got this going on. So just enough to maintain the spiral structure, but not enough where you're going to have disturbed features. And as I said, it's not highly feathered or spurred. If I could show you one that is. Let's see if we got one here. Well, this is an example of one where this is one of the galaxies that has been picked out as being a sister to our Milky Way galaxy. But you do notice that there's a lot more spurring and feathering in the spiral arms. The spiral arms almost kind of blend into one another because of all the substructure in between the spiral arms. And there's also zones where you've got a lot more star formation going on, and there's a much bigger black hole in the center. And by the way, let me show you what happens when you have a fairly significant galaxy that collides with your galaxy. You get something like this. Okay? This is M82 in the constellation Ursa Major. And it has experienced a merger event about 250 million years ago. And it was used to be called the exploding galaxy, but actually it's just simply a merger event that's going on. And the red stuff here is ionized hydrogen. So it's showing you where the future zones of star formation will take place. So this is actually a spiral galaxy, but you can already tell it's a spiral galaxy because the structure has been so extremely disturbed. And then star formation is going to be taking place perpendicular to the spiral structure. So rather a strange-looking galaxy. Here's another couple of galaxies that are in the process of merging together. And when they come together, you notice that the spiral structure is the first to go. So we had nice; these are both nice spiral galaxies until they ran into one another. And once they, and by the way, the collision's still in process. They're coming towards one another. As they come towards one another, you can see the spiral structure. Incidentally, a lot of astronomers have fun just modeling collisions, where they kind of use computers and watch what happens. But by doing that computer modeling, they can duplicate all the things that we see going on in the universe. So we actually got good understanding here. But the bottom line is, what we're discovering as we look at all these, well, here's another one where you can see that rather than getting nice circularly shaped fire alarm structures. You've got this one coming off at an angle, and you see some substructure developing here. This one also comes off at an angle. This is very difficult. Most spiral galaxies, you can see a significant disturbance in the structure of the spiral arms and a significant lack of symmetry. So this is what most spiral galaxies look like. And you can see here the galaxy that's partly responsible for developing this substructure. And let me see if I can pick up another one here for you. Oh, by the way, when you see something like this, where you get a perfect circle going around it, and by the way, in the background, there's a little hole here. We can look through it to what looks beyond. This is a very distant galaxy where the same thing has happened, right in there. You can see, and this, how this you get this perfect circular structure is you have a spiral galaxy where a fairly big galaxy makes a head-on collision right through the nucleus. So you can look at this as a target. And so it has to come in straight, perpendicular, and it has to hit right here. And when it does that, the spiral structure forms this nice circular pattern here. However, again, a very nasty place to try to have life existing because of the radiation. Because what happens is you get the huge growth in the black hole, and this whole area gets strongly irradiated. And let me see if I can... Yeah, this is an example of a spiral galaxy with lots of substructure. See all the feathering and spurs that go on between the spiral arms. There really is no safe place to put a solar system here where we could have life. What would be exceptional in the case of our Milky Way galaxy is that you've got essentially empty space in here where the star and its planets can roam around the center of our galaxy, not bump into a spiral arm, and not bump into anything significant in between. That wouldn't happen in this galaxy. Yeah. Well, that's it. Let me come back to ours here. Here we go. You want a few collisions or absorptions, but what you really want is for your home galaxy to absorb a dwarf galaxy or a sub-dwarf galaxy on a regular basis. What's more typical is you'll absorb two or three all at once. And then you'll go a long period of time where you don't absorb any. You really want to be absorbing them at a regular pace. About once every half billion years is ideal. Or once every, say, 400 million years would be ideal. And you don't want them any bigger than, say, the Small Magellanic Cloud. That'd be the biggest you would want. But if you don't have those regular absorption events taking place, that will not permit and sufficient gas and dust to stream out from the center where these galaxies are being absorbed into the spiral arm. There's a density wave pattern that funnels the gas and dust out into the spiral arms. And it's that gas and dust being funneled out which leads to new star formation events, and it also stabilizes the structure of the spiral arms. And so if you stop absorbing those galaxies, the spiral structure will, in a relatively short period of time, decay and collapse the galaxy. Well, it did 10 billion years ago, because those merger events filled intergalactic space with metal. And then those metals get absorbed by the dwarf galaxies get absorbed by our galaxy, and therefore we have the appropriate enrichment of those metals in order to make a planet like Earth. And that's quite a challenge. I mean, of all the objects we can see in our Milky Way galaxy, planet Earth still ranks as the most heavy element rich of those bodies. I mean, planet Earth is much more heavy metal rich than any other planet in our solar system. And because of that heavy metal richness, we can have plate tectonics and a strong magnetic field, plus all these elements that we can mine to sustain high technology civilization. And that took literally billions of years of highly fine-tuned input of metals into our Milky Way galaxy. you know, this catalog I was referring to, where we've got these 800 characteristics that must be fine-tuned to make life possible. Well, probably 50 or 60 of those fine-tuned characteristics have to deal with ensuring that you get the right quantity and diversity of heavy metals in the environment of the newly forming solar system. And by the way, you want to make sure you don't have too many heavy metals, too, or too many of the wrong kind. What's unusual about our solar system and planet Earth is how rich it is in uranium and thorium. And it's that uranium and thorium enrichment of our solar system and planet Earth in particular that allows us to have billions of years of plate tectonics. And without that, we wouldn't have a planet where you've got oceans and continents in a stable configuration with one another for a long period of time. And you wouldn't have the cycling of nutrients from the continents to the oceans and oceans back to the continents. What would be typical of most planets is that even if everything else fine-tuned, is that you would get the nutrients running in one direction only, not being recycled. So that's one of the features of planet Earth, is how efficiently it's able to recycle the nutrients throughout the environment. Yeah. It did. And, you know, what I find interesting is that if you go back about 650 million years, maybe a little bit before that, you've got the solar system crossing a spiral arm. And it's also the same time that our Milky Way galaxy was absorbing a dwarf galaxy. So that would be a period of time in which you wouldn't want to have the creator creating advanced life. But what we notice is that 543 million years ago is when we have the Cambrian explosion, where we got this burst of advanced life with large bodies and complex body plans. And it's because the Creator knew that now that we've gone through a spiral arm crossing, and now that we're in a region where the spiral arms are far apart and there's not much disturbance going on between those spiral arms, there's going to be a long period of time when the Creator can count on the stable conditions necessary for advanced life. So he creates advanced life and creates it very aggressively and puts us human beings on the scene at the safest time of all. And so there was a danger zone, but the danger zone was before we had the Cambrian explosion event. So you say, well, how many times have we crossed the spiral arms? Well, probably four or five times in the history of the Earth. And that's one of the unique design features, is we happen to be on a planetary system where there's very few spiral arm crossings. And the reason why is that we happen to be the just right distance from the center of the galaxy. Because there's a certain distance from the center of the galaxy where this spiral arm structure will rotate at the same rate that a star will revolve around the center of the galaxy. It's about 250 million years it takes to make one trip around the center of the galaxy. And where we are, that's the same rate that the spiral structure goes around. Now, what that means is that you're not going to bump into spiral arms very often. You know, here we are in between two spiral arms, and because we're going around the center of the galaxy at exactly the same rate that the, not exactly, but similar to the rate at which the spiral structure rotates, we get to stay in between those two spiral arms. Now, if it was exactly at the co-rotation distance, we would be in trouble. Why? Because if you're exactly at the co-rotation distance, and you're going to get what's called a mean motion resonance, you're going to get gravitational pulls and tugs that will accumulate over time and significantly disturb the star system. And so what we notice about our solar system is it's close to the co-rotation distance, but just a little bit inside, sufficiently inside that it doesn't get these mean motion resonance catastrophes, and yet sufficiently close to the co-rotation distance that it has the benefit of staying in between two spiral arms for a long period of time. And so right now, we're almost exactly halfway in between, but we're moving towards a collision event with this next spiral arm, but that won't happen for a few hundred more million years. And this happens to be the one time in the solar system's history where we get the longest period between crossings of spiral arms. Now, the evolutionists have to argue all this is coincidental, accidental. The creationist says, no, God had this all planned well in advance and timed the creations of life just right. And, you know, this is something that, we're working on at Reasons to Believe, is that one of the problems of evolutionary biology is they tend to only look at the biology. And they're not aware of the physics of the sun and the physics of our Milky Way galaxy. That really does determine why the history of the fossil record looks the way it does. And looks the way it does in such a way that testifies not to mindless evolution, but to a creator who knows exactly what's happening to the physics of our galaxy, the physics of our solar system, the Earth and the sun in particular, and creates life at just the right time, and at just the right abundance, and at just the right type. In order to compensate for all the changes that are going on in our galaxy and our solar system. Because it takes life of the right form in order to make sure you're cycling nutrients through the environment at the right rate to compensate for the changes that are going on in the physics of the sun and the Milky Way galaxy. That's a little bit more than what I wanted to say this morning. I just kind of wanted to show you some galaxies and show you what was so different and special about our galaxy compared to the other galaxies. We can put it up on the website. I've actually got this loaded as my screensaver, so. The one warning is I do have some photographs here that are copywritten, which means you can use them for educational purposes. You can put them on your computer, but you can't use them for commercial purposes. Although about 90% of them are copyright free. So there are some beautiful ones I wanted to grab that. Did have copyrights on them. This one? I'm not sure. I don't think it is. By the way, anything that's produced by our government, by law, has to be public domain. And virtually, well, I'd say about 90% of these images were produced by government observatories. Yeah, John. Yeah, as I mentioned, our solar system has made about four or five crossings of the spiral arm since it was formed 4.5 billion years ago. Okay, when you cross the spiral arm, you'll be exposed to intense ultraviolet radiation. You'll also be exposed to supernova eruptions and gravitational disturbances from nearby stars. So yeah, it's not a pleasant experience to go across the spiral arm, and it would sure ruin the astronomy and sure ruin research. Observe the universe. Almost anywhere else in our Milky Way galaxy, your view would either be blocked by dust or it would be washed out by the light in your vicinity. But fortunately, we're in virtually the darkest spot of our Milky Way galaxy. I mean, it is darker way out here, but it's impossible to have a life out there. You won't have the heavy element abundance. But in terms of where you can have elements that would make life possible, we are indeed in the darkest spot in our Milky Way galaxy. And our Milky Way galaxy is in one of the darkest spots of the universe. Therefore, we can see everything. Yeah. Yes, you do have stars way out here that are not attached to any galaxy. So there are not a lot of interloper stars. I mean, you do get some, because when galaxies collide, some of the stars get ejected from both systems. And so we'll be littering intergalactic space. However, a lot of those stars get gobbled up again by the galaxies. I mean, if I were to show you a cluster of galaxies again, for example, let's go back to this one, say. The galaxies are so close together that any stars you've got wandering out here by themselves in due time will be picked up by the galaxies. So there's not a lot of stars in between the galaxies. Yes, Jocelyn. Yes. It's a reconstruction of what our galaxy would look like, a fairly accurate reconstruction. It is, but you're making a good point. As we look at the billions of galaxies in the universe, we don't find any Milky Way twins. No, this again is not a photograph of a galaxy. We did not tend to take a spaceship millions of light years away and look down on our galaxy. We don't have those kinds of craft that can do that for us. There are no galaxies that look like this. Ours is the only one that has this small bar and this extremely symmetrical spiral structure, which would allow for the existence of life. I mean, there's been a quest by astronomers to find a Milky Way twin. You know, this whole idea of Star Wars, a galaxy far, far away where there's always life existing on it. We can't find a galaxy near or far that would be sufficiently like our Milky Way galaxy that would be able to sustain advanced life. Some have speculated maybe bacterial life, but in terms of advanced life, and by the way, run into the same problem with our sun. There's been a quest in the last few years to find a solar twin, and we can't find any twins of our star that are sufficiently like our sun that would be capable of supporting advanced life. There are no solar twins, and there are no twins to our planetary system. You know, now they have found about 150 planetary systems, and none of them are anywhere near like our planetary system, our solar system. So we seem to be unique on all three levels. The star is unique, the planetary system is unique, and the galaxy is unique. There's a fourth feature, the galaxy cluster in which we live is also unique. We can't find any twins to the local group. So it's unique on all scales, which again argues for a creator rather than a cosmic accident. Yeah, one more question, then we want to get into Job. Yes. It has changed over time. Well, a little bit younger, it wouldn't have looked a lot different. But if you go back 10 billion years, that's when our galaxy was being constructed. Big Bang creation model tells us that the universe starts off with a lot of star clusters. Clusters like this. Here we go. So this is what the universe starts off with. Lots of features like this. And then they begin to merge together. And as they merge together, they make mini galaxies. And the mini galaxies merge together to make medium-sized galaxies. And they merge together to make large galaxies. And this is still going on today. It's called the hierarchical model of Big Bang cosmology. And so our Milky Way galaxy would have started off with a bunch of these that merged together. However, our Milky Way galaxy's structure was virtually intact when the universe was only about a billion years old. So it built up fairly quickly, and from that point onward, it's been growing at a slow pace. And that's still the case. Our galaxy is gradually accumulating mass, but at a relatively slow rate, and at such a regular rate that its spiral structure does not get disturbed, and we don't get a lot of buildup of feathers and spurs. Okay. I think I'm going to close off this discussion. We could talk about galaxies all day. That was my research specialty when I was at Caltech. But let's get into our lesson in the Book of Job. And Job was looking up at the stars, too. It's interesting, you go through the Book of Job, how often he refers to the stars that they were seeing. And, of course, without modern technology, they could see a lot more than we see. I don't know where you were when you saw the Milky Way spiral arms. It certainly wasn't in the Los Angeles area. In fact, it's difficult even to see that almost anywhere in California these days. Although the place... Yeah. Well, those of you who are on our star party, this place up by Wrightwood, you could see the Milky Way quite easily from that location. That's about the nearest location I can think of where you can drive and actually see easily the Milky Way galaxy and the spiral arms that are in there. Okay, we've been going through the Bible, picking up all these verses that talk about how the record of nature reveals God, reveals His attributes, and even reveals his plan of salvation to humanity. I mean, it's quite remarkable how strongly these verses make the statement that this gospel has been preached to all the peoples of the world, even those that have had no contact with Christians or the Bible. And one example of that is what we see in the book of Job. Many people think Job was the first book ever recorded for the Bible, although it's possible it was recorded at the same time that the Mosaic books were written. But Job obviously lived about 3,500 years ago and possibly quite a bit earlier. And yet we see Job referring to the elements of the gospel, and as he debates his four friends, three were against him, one was for him, one was for him, kept quiet. Isn't that the way it is with debates? The guy that's on your side stays real quiet until the very end. That was kind of the way it was with Job and his debate. So, but as he was talking to his three antagonists, he made reference to what God has revealed through the record of nature. And we've actually looked at some of these verses in Job. These are some additional ones that Job quotes as evidence that there's got to be a God up there that has created the universe and has created life. He says, "In his hand is the life of every creature and the breath of all mankind." And later on in the discussion, Job makes the point that if God were to withdraw his presence from any one of us, our life would be immediately snuffed out. And so with every breath we take, we need to thank God for the fact that the breath is enabling us to continue living. And, you know, it's remarkable that, and by the way, Job's three friends did not contest this. Several of these points, Job is able to state without his friends contesting. They said, yes, we agree that there's got to be a creator to explain why there's life at all. And as we mentioned last week, we have the Origin of Life research community talking about how we can put all the chemicals together to make a living organism. But the one thing they seem to not pay any attention to, how do we explain the switch that tells all that complex machinery inside the cell to start running? You know, an analogy I used last week was the automobile. You've got an automobile that's beautifully designed to take you to work, but it's not going to go there unless you put the key in the ignition and turn the key over and get the engine running. What is it that tells this bacterium with these thousands of proteins inside of it and the RNA and DNA molecules, what tells it to actually start running? And for that matter, what tells it to quit running? There's an ignition switch, and the point that Job makes is God's the one that turns us on and makes us live. He's also the one that decides when to turn the ignition off. So the car analogy, I think, is work. You get in the car, you turn on the ignition. When the car has fulfilled its purpose for your particular trip, you turn the ignition off. And Job's point is that's how God operates. He decides when we'll live, and then he decides when we'll die. And Job had the confidence to recognize, in spite of all the suffering he was going through, it wasn't his time. And that God would be the one that would tell him when that time was up. I saw a hand over here somewhere. Yes. Well, every Christian I've talked to says that after they've become a Christian. Okay, because you've made that commitment to Christ, you're submitted to Him, the Holy Spirit is ministering to you in a way that was not the case when you're not yet a believer. And years ago in this study, we went through what the Holy Spirit does in the life of every individual. He does five things for every human being. But for Christians, He does eight more things. And so when you give your life to Christ, there's revelation that you receive that you weren't receiving in the past. And if you were with us a few weeks ago, we spent quite a bit of time going through Romans 1, 18 to 32, trying to understand why it is that the non-Christian is not able to see this overwhelming case for the God of the Bible. But I mean, talk to people in the class here and talk to them, what was it like when you were not yet a Christian? And what was it like when you became a Christian? Everybody I've talked to has a story where they say the blinders were lifted. It's like they were reading this book. I remember reading this book as a non-Christian, and things just weren't making sense in certain passages. Once I gave my life to the control of the Creator of the universe, then when I started going through this passage, like, well, why didn't I see that before? But there's a blindness that comes over the unbeliever. And that's what Romans 1 talks about. It's self-imposed ignorance. It's not that the evidence isn't strong enough. It's that we're refusing to see that evidence, and we refuse to understand. And there's certain reasons why. Anyway, you can get the tapes. I think we spent about 3 weeks on Romans 1 as to what happens when you look at this evidence and say, you know, there's no God here. And your people refuse to see the evidence in certain ways. And it's pride all the way. But I thought what was interesting in our time is that, you know, when you reject the evidence for God by refusing to look at that evidence as self-imposed ignorance, it impairs your ability to do good science. It impairs your ability to be a good lover, and it impairs your ability to think. And that's exactly what you see in Romans 1, is people persist in their denial of seeing and understanding that overwhelming evidence through the record of nature for the God of the Bible. Step by step, their personality becomes impaired, and they lose their ability to do good science. And secondarily, they lose their ability to love other people. And then they become impaired in their capacity to think. And again, to think about the most important issues of life. Okay, there must be a creator. Let me actually get a show up here for you, all right? This will be... there we go. In his hand is the life of every creature and the breath of all mankind. And then Job made a second point. God not only exists, we can tell from the record of nature that he must be extremely powerful and extremely wise. It looks like I'm running out of time. Oh my. I apologize. Okay. I'm not going to get any farther than I got last week. I mean, I won't be here next week. I'll be in Florida, but I will be here the week thereafter. Appreciate your prayers for a Florida trip. We're going to be in Fort Myers, Florida. We're taking almost all of our scholar team there, doing a creation conference, and we've got people from several states that are coming for the conference. And that's the way. We've got a lot of new talks. I want you to pray for the scholars, because a lot of them are giving talks they've not given before. And this is all a prelude for the biggest conference we've ever done, which will be in Houston in the month of February. So, and the Houston churches there seem to be, I mean, they're really going all out. What's fun is how competitive they are. Because they heard about the conference we did at Willow Creek Community Church in Chicago and how successful that was. And they said, we're going to do better than they did in every respect. So I said, okay, go for it. So, but I appreciate your prayers. I'm going to have to slip away pretty quickly from here, too. So I'm going to ask that you not keep me very long here. I actually have a Reasons to Believe Canada board meeting that I have to preside over within a few minutes. We're all going to connect through telephone. We were trying to get together, the whole board, the Canadian board, but, you know, in Canada, people live 4,000 miles apart from one another. So we're going to try to do it over the phones. And I'm the guy that's going to actually run this conference call, so appreciate your prayers that would go smoothly. And, well, hopefully, well, we get to save a lot of money. We don't have to travel and all that kind of stuff, but it is a little more challenging. You can't see people's faces. Okay, let me just say a word of prayer, a word of thanks for Job and Elihu, and next time we get together, we'll get through these two Gospels, and you get two. One is preached by Job, and then we get another one from Elihu. And it's quite interesting how different Elihu's gospel is compared to Job's. And what I like about the two is that Job brings up different points than, or Elihu brings up different points than Job does, but it's very complementary what Job is saying. It's kind of like this young man saying, Job was able to figure all this out from the record of nature. Let me show you what I could figure out from the record of nature. He put the two together, and it's incredible the detail on the message of salvation these men were able to draw strictly from the record of nature. But I want to remind you, they were both remarkable men, men of enormous humility. And because of that humility, they didn't have that blinding of the mind that prevented them from seeing what God had revealed. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we pray for each one of us here that you would give us the spirit of Job and the spirit of Elihu. Give us the humility to see what you've revealed to us through the words in the Bible and through the record of nature, which you've written upon our hearts. Thank you for the conscience you've given each one of us. Help us to be extra sensitive to what you're revealing to us through these remarkable revelations. Give us the humility before you and before one another, that we may be free of self-imposed ignorance, free of self-blindness, and actually see the glorious light of what you're teaching and revealing to each one of us. And we thank you, Lord, that you revealed yourself in such a way that all of us, no matter where we are, no matter what situation we're in, can see and receive your light. And in receiving your light, receive your truth, your love, and your life, your eternal life with you. In Jesus' name, amen.